So, I was asked to speak on the last chapter of James. We've had a series over the last few months looking at James. Peter's done a bit. We've had some guest speakers come in. I am not a fan of James. So this is a challenge. James has been used for too much bad legalistic, moralistic theology as the textual support. It doesn't mean that's what James is, but I have so much baggage about James being the hit-you-over-the-head verse for all sorts of things I disagree with. So, I've really struggled to get into this text and read a big pile of commentaries in the hope that something would inspire me. And literally on the last page of the last commentary, some words about the last verse suddenly struck a chord. I was getting a bit desperate there at the end. So I'm going to start there and we'll work back into the text because not only did it strike a chord, it actually made me really excited, which considering I've spent the last 2 weeks telling Tyson every day how much I don't like James and how it's not getting anywhere, was quite exciting. Now, as always when I speak, I'll try and do some bits for people who can't bear to listen for half an hour, so you can only listen to little bits. So if you're only listening to a little bit, I'm going to give you the conclusion at the start and then you can stop listening. So the last two verses say, "My brothers and sisters, if one of you strays away from the truth and another brings them back to it, they may be sure that anyone who can bring back a sinner from their erring ways will be saving their soul from death and covering over many a sin." That's the last lines of the whole letter of James. Now, the passage that Luke and Jen read for us today is an enormous passage and ending quite an enormous book in terms of its content, and that's how it ends. It's a very odd and abrupt way to end a letter. And rather than sending wishes for blessing, which is how you might expect to end, James sends instructions for how to obtain your blessing. But still, this is the conclusion of the book. So you might expect that this is what James is really on about. This is where he finishes. The commentator Patrick Harton, the last commentary I read, described this as the Great Commission of James. We're probably all familiar with the Great Commission of Matthew. Go into all the world and make disciples. It's a going out commission. It's a spreading the good news to people who've never heard the good news, who don't have any connection with Jesus, making new disciples. But James's concern is his own community right throughout. The whole book encourages those within to develop their identity, and I'm quoting Harton now, where friendship with God is the ultimate test and criteria, that's the identity of the community. Friendship with God is the ultimate test and criteria. So the great commission of James, the great conclusion, is to gather up those who already know the good news and draw them into that friendship. James is on about being friends of the world or friends of God. Draw people into the friendship with God. Not people out in the wilds of suburbia who've never heard of Jesus, but people who do know Jesus, but for whatever reason are wandering. It uses the wonderful Greek word planaeo, which means to wander, and it's the word the Greeks used for planets, planaeo. It's where we get planets from. Now, we know that planets follow a very organised and logical and structured path, so much so that you can send something out 9 years in advance and meet it. I've been thinking a lot about planets in the last few weeks, with Jupiter and Venus aligning, and then we visited Pluto this week, and they're not wandering at all. But for the Greeks looking up in the sky, the stars had their place, but the planets moved around, so they were the wanderers. How many of us here have been planaeo believers? I'm actually asking you this question. Are you still a wanderer? Maybe your family are wanderers, or maybe your friends are. This feels like the Great Commission for MHCC. particularly for us. We are not very good at Pauline evangelism, taking the good news out. Many of us, maybe it's just me and I'm projecting, but I think many of us feel unskilled, unequipped, ungifted, even uncalled for that kind of evangelism. But here is a great commission that makes sense to me. And I tentatively suggest that we here are gifted and equipped for making space for the wandering souls to reconnect with their identity as friends of God. Friends of the God of love. I'm going to say that a couple of times, and then if you don't want to listen to the rest, you can stop. I think we at Mount Hawthorn are called to draw believers in from their wandering to be a space of refuge and return. I think James can be our particular commission to find the wanderers and welcome them into a space of refuge and return. So if this is our great commission, what is this community that we are making ready as a welcome? James is all about perfecting communities, all about perfection, how to live together and who to be. Now, as a recovering perfectionist, I hate the word perfection. So I'll work with the Greek word is, well, the Greek word for perfect is teleos, or perfection is teleotes. Thank you. Teleotes, perfection. And you can also translate those as complete or mature. Perfection as wholeness or integrity. Now that I can go on with. I can sign up with James spending five chapters encouraging us to wholeness, maturity, integrity. And we'll see as we dive into this chapter that teleotes is not about making no errors, but about a mature wholeness of community life. So I told you if you were a limited listener, you could stop. But actually, I've got a couple more bits for you, and this is one of them. Friendship is a two-way relationship. We are friends, not followers of God. God loves us. How do we love God? And the enormous passage Luke and Jen read, two big answers to that. And the first answer, which Jen read, is we are to be good news. If we are to be good news, we need to be good news into our socioeconomic context. Robert Wall says, good deeds are crucial, but they must embody good news. How many of us know examples of people coming with good deeds that actually are bad news for the people who get them? Good deeds are crucial, but they must embody good news. Good news is central, but must be lived in a world desperate for both social and spiritual salvation. In other words, good news must be embodied within socially unjust realities. So I was asked to speak on chapter 5, but the passage really begins at chapter 4, verse 13, so it bridges over the chapter gap, and I've taken that as well. From 4:13 to 5:6, there's a polemic against both the wealthy and the wannabe wealthy, it has the tone and the imagery of the prophets. It even warns that Yahweh Sabaoth is coming. Now, Yahweh Sabaoth is not normally in the New Testament. Yahweh Sabaoth is the warrior god of the prophets. Yahweh Sabaoth is coming. The first section attacks the merchants, and the second aims at wealthy landowners. The merchants were possibly very large-scale traders, because it talks about them moving for a year to this town or that town, moving from town to town to managing a trading empire. Or it could be talking about those who are climbing the ladder, who are not yet wealthy enough to sit back on their large estate and let someone else go out. So they're amassing their fortunes. The landowners have a long history of squeezing out poor farmers, taking their land, and then turning those poor farmers into day labourers. Day labourers are extremely vulnerable because they're only paid when there's work, and some of the times of the year when there's not work are also the hardest times of the year, especially winter. And they could starve, quite literally. James's community receiving this letter is almost certainly poor. In fact, probably very, very poor. In all those Pauline letters where Paul keeps saying to his Greek churches, send money for the Jews, for the Christians in Jerusalem, well, that's probably this lot. They're so poor that the Greek new Christians are sending money to support them. Somewhere along the line in Christian history, we moved from being the poor to caring for the poor, often paternalistically. It's really important when we read some of these texts, and this one in particular, that we understand that this was a church who was poor. So neither the merchants nor the landowners are actually in the community hearing this letter. And they probably never will hear these warnings. So why put them in there? And as a side note, some of the prophets, and this is very echoes the prophets in lots of ways, some of the prophets did the same thing. They wrote letters to one community with a great polemic against a different community who weren't very likely to hear it. So there's a particular rhetorical style. Why would you do that? Some of the reasons you might do that. One is if James's community is aspiring to wealth. Howard's Battlers comes to mind. And James is really concerned to show how wealth leads away from God. He's not concerned actually with the money. He's concerned with the arrogance. That taking money as the centre instead of listening to God is the issue. And poor people lusting after wealth can have the same problem, where wealth, the lack of it or the gain of it, becomes the guiding force. James is saying, aspiring for wealth is doomed. It could be that James's community is seeking patronage from wealthy people around them. It's a logical thing to do if you're a poor community, particularly in a politically vulnerable situation in the Roman Empire, to seek some wealthy people around you who will be your patrons, which is a relationship we don't really have in our society. Sponsorship is probably the nearest thing we have, and that's quite a corporate thing. Patronage was much more interpersonal, and at its very best, it meant a reciprocal care. At its worst, which was what was more common, it meant a whole lot of people who were at the service of somebody wealthy who didn't really give them very much at all. There's some suggestion that the churches, the poor churches, were seeking wealthy patrons in order to look after themselves. James says that's not okay, because that's seeking security in someone's wealth, a person, rather than seeking security in God. It's also not okay because some of those wealthy people are abusing the members of your church, which is what the bit about the landowners suggests. And earlier in James, he's talked about taking people to court, being taken into court. Probably the wealthy are taking his poor church members into court and using their wealth and power to make sure that they always win. So you can see there's a significant problem. If we as a community decide we'd like to have as a sponsor, I don't want to name any ex-corporate agency that runs a business up the road, but also our young people are working there for $4 an hour. That's the sort of situation he's addressing. Another possibility why you would write this to people who are not wealthy is that by pointing to people outside the group who've really, really got it wrong, you can encourage those within the group to reorient to what is essential in their own lives. And what is essential always for James is friendship with God as our identity. So by saying, look what they've done and it's going very badly for them, he's saying, don't let's make the same mistakes. Another possibility is that the wealthy are oppressing James's community, and these are words of comfort for the poor. That actually, it's not intended that the wealthy will change their ways. He's saying to the poor, God will get them in the end. And he goes on in the bit that Luke then read to encourage endurance while you wait for God to get around to that vengeance. Very strongly says, don't do it yourself. An affirmation that God is on the side of the poor. So when we read it, we hear the terribly strong tone and it's quite affronting. But if you're a poor person hearing that, it's comforting. If it's not comforting for you, that is probably a flag to where you sit in terms of this passage. If the concluding commission of the whole book is that we are bringing back those who have wandered, it is perhaps possible that there are some wealthy people who have heard the message of Jesus, somehow connected, and now wandered away, and that this is a way to encourage James's community to bring them back, repent, turn back, and become friends of God. So, do we listen to James as the poor or as the wealthy? If you're only listening to a little bit, that's one to hang on to. Do we listen as the poor or as the wealthy? Here within us, we have a range of social situations and backgrounds, including some of us who support the poor, and some of us who in Australian community really are not very wealthy. So it's not a blanket even here within us at Mount Hawthorn. So if we listen as the poor, the key theme is God is with you. Hang on to that. God is with you. When you walk out the door and you are poor and everything seems against you, God is on your side. If you listen as the poor, don't set your life to achieving wealth, either for yourself or as sponsorship. If you're poor, be patient and endure. I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. And if you're poor, don't take vengeance into your own hands. It's God's business. If you listen as the wealthy, especially if you listen as a wealthy community, the key theme is beware. Beware. Beware, at chapter 4, verse 16, beware the arrogance of thinking we are in control. At verse 17, beware getting caught up in our money and forgetting to do the right thing. In 5, verse 2 and 3, beware, our wealth is useless when it really counts. Now, it uses the language of judgment day, but we know that when we are ill, our wealth is useless. When our relationships are challenged, our wealth is useless. In matters of love, our wealth is useless. There's very strong language in this passage. Some of the strongest language about wealth and poverty in the whole New Testament. Beware that amassing wealth is amassing evidence against yourself. It's a really interesting judicial image that at the last times God will judge you, and when God calls for the evidence, if you have wealth in your evidence, it will be a witness against you. The rust, the image at verse 5, the rust on hoarded money will eat into the flesh of the ones who's hoarding. That's extremely strong. The big concern seems to be that hoarding wealth means we don't use it. And the poor that it's intended for don't get to use it either. Rust and decay are both signs of something not used. If you wear your clothes, the moths don't eat them, but if you leave them in the cupboard, they do. If you use your money, it doesn't tarnish, but if it just sits there, it does. So it's a sign that things intended for good purposes are put out of use. If you hear this as the wealthy, beware that God hears the cries of those who worked for your comforts, our comforts, who've not been properly paid. That's chapter 5, verse 4. Now, in Western Australia, I don't know how many of you are aware that through the middle of the 20th century, pastoral workers, Aboriginal pastoral workers, had their wages put into accounts as safekeeping, and they have never been paid that money. It's disappeared. Now, that probably wasn't me, or you, or even your families, but our wealthy state is built on things like that. Those pastoral workers' wages went into the pockets of the people who became our elites, who've built our state. God hears the cries of the poor who didn't get that money. Our cheap clothes, our electrical goods, our imported foods are often at the expense of underpaid or slavishly employed workers. Think about how long it would take you to sew a shirt. If you've got a sewer in your house, you'll have an idea, but I'm a reasonable sewer, and even a very, very simple shirt would take me a couple of hours. Now, I can buy that for my children for $4. Someone in the supply chain is not getting paid. Even if they are very efficient and can do that in 20 minutes, they are not being paid. When I buy something that's cost $4 for a couple of hours of work, someone is not getting paid for the work that supports my comforts. God hears the cries of those. The language actually says that the money we didn't pay cries out to God. And God hears that money in the wrong hands. Beware, wealthy, if you're living a life of comfort, you are fattening yourself up. Now, if you fatten up a farm animal, what are you fattening it up for? Even as poetry, and this is poetry, even as poetry, this is very alarming. Beware, our injustices kill the righteous. This is at 5 verse 6. Literally, our injustices are sending workers to the grave. The language is quite specific. It could possibly mean that the wealth, our pursuit of wealth, pursues, because the righteous one, could even mean that our pursuit of wealth has killed the righteous one as Jesus. It's legal language. It says you are guilty of their murder. This is why I had asked Rani to include a time of confession, because we cannot listen to this and not feel a heaviness. And all the talk of the day of slaughter makes me very, very uncomfortable. How do I reconcile this with 5 verse 11, where it says, "For we know that the Lord is compassionate and kind." It's in the same passage. I'm not integrating across the Bible. There is not an easy answer to this. All I can cling to is that when God judges, God chooses to look at me and see Jesus, if I will allow it. In that light, judgment is not fearsome, because if I'm holding on to Jesus, I will be judged with Jesus. The judge is already waiting at the gate and has promised to judge in Jesus' favour. In fact, he doesn't say which side of the gate the judge is waiting on. Perhaps the judge is with us, waiting to knock on the gate, to let us in. I have to admit that that is taking the passage in a direction it probably didn't intend. But I like to think that the judge could be on our side of the gate. Certainly, the overall heart of the scripture is that God wants us to be saved and to be made whole. Meanwhile, though, it is pretty clear that there is some work to do. This text is not about the end times. It uses end time imagery to add a sense of urgency to its instructions for here and now. It's also primarily not to warn the rich about end time judgment, but to assure the poor of end time restoration. Now, having raised the spectre of a pretty gruesome day of judgment, James goes on to speak pastorally to his community, confirming that they are the poor. He wouldn't speak in that pastoral tone if he was speaking to the rich at this point. In fact, if he was addressing the rich, I suggest he would use quite a different tone to talk about the sin of wealth as well. the real polemic over the top tone is the way you talk about something when you're making a point over here. Ecclesiastes is written to the rich rather than to the poor. And some of the language, the part that Jen read, talked about, you are just a, don't you know, you're just mist. It's the same word as in Ecclesiastes. You're just meaningless. Vapour, mist, that word, which is terribly untranslatable, is the same word here. So he's alluding to this as well. If he was speaking directly to the rich, he might include the possibility of hope and forgiveness. But he's speaking to the poor, and he urges patience. And he says, have patience like the prophets. The prophets are some of the least patient people I can think of. He especially says, be patient like Job. Now, there is an oral tradition of Job that doesn't have the big complaints in it. Well, it does have some of them, but they're in his wife's voice. Job doesn't complain. So the bookends of the Job we have, where Job is very noble and suffers and suffers, and then at the end everything is restored, there's an oral tradition that has only, it's much bigger, but it basically expands those ends. And all the fascinating dialogues of the middle of Job that we have weren't in, possibly James doesn't know that complaining Job. But even so, even the other prophets, they are always complaining. But endurance or perseverance, that they do know, the prophets. Endurance and perseverance is about sticking with it through it all and not losing sight of God. The example is like the poor farmer. The poor farmer doesn't have enough food to get through the whole 12 months if the rains are late. The poor farmer puts everything into the next crop and rations out the last bit of food, and if that rain doesn't come, that family dies. Be patient and endure like the poor farmer waiting for the rains that ensure the crop. And endure together. Don't grumble at each other. It doesn't just say don't grumble, thank goodness, but it says don't grumble at each other. The prophets, the model, did lots of grumbling, but they grumbled to the Lord about the injustice. And that is not the same as bitching and moaning about the people we are sharing community with. The problem of grumbling is that grumbling against each other sets the community against each other and tears us apart. I personally would even go so far as to say grumbling, complaining about injustice in the right ways is part of our calling. And I think James just did it. If he wasn't meant to do that, he's in trouble. So the second half of the response, the first half of how do we live as this community, that is to welcome the wanderers, is to live in this socioeconomic context. To be very, very aware of how we listen as rich and poor, who we are and who we're with. The second part is how we live together while we wait for things to come right. There's enduring and not grumbling, as I've already mentioned. Live together with honesty and integrity. Chapter 5, verse 12, above all, have no oaths. Really, above all? Of everything he's got to say? No. Above all is a phrase like, and in conclusion I say, and it's the mark that we're getting to the end of the whole book, this is the end bit now. James, as we heard, doesn't really end like you'd expect a letter to end, but this is one of the flags that is picking up some of the cultural norms of how you would end a letter and adjusting them. Normally in a letter, you would say above all, and then you would make an oath. And James is saying, above all, we've got to the end, don't make an oath. Now this, it gets translated as don't swear. Now I think that's by Bible translators who like people with clean mouths. Because it's not about whether you say naughty words. An oath is when, if I say to Rani, I'll meet you for coffee tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And I say to Paul, I swear by earth, I will meet you for coffee tomorrow at 11 o'clock. I've made an oath. Now, I've just made two levels of truth. I'm more likely to turn up for coffee with Paul. You're more likely to think I'll be with Paul than with Rani. If I'm with Rani and it's going very nicely, I'm more like, well, I better go. I've said I'll be there at 11 and I've sworn by heaven. James says, let yes be yes and no be no. We do not have levels of truth in the community. It's true or it's not true. You said you would or you didn't. The second thing is to pray. Pray in the good times and pray in the bad times, and they are intertwined. They're in the same sentence. If you've got trouble, pray. If you've got joy, sing. This is addressed to the community. They are intertwined and you are not alone. Don't just stoically endure, pray. It's an active thing to do as you endure. Now the way it's written gives the impression that prayer works like a magic trick. And if you pray extra super hard, chapter 5 verse 15, the prayer of faith will save and heal the sick. 5 verse 16, prayer of the upright is very powerful. But prayer is not magic. But prayer arising from the shared life of people together in faithful relationship to God is a powerful thing. It is part of the breathing in and breathing out of God. I'll say that again. Prayer arising out of a faithful shared life is part of the breathing in and breathing out of God. Which, when we breathe in and out, we say, Yahweh. We are breathing in and out God. The effect is never guaranteed. But it is a community response, not a grasping for yourself. And the exemplar given is Elijah. Now, Elijah was heralded as the possible Messiah. But he's not given here because he's awesome. He's given because he's ordinary. It says Elijah was a human being as frail as ourselves, who had the ear of God. Righteousness is a sign of God's presence, not a precursor to it. Prayer makes him a model of righteousness. He's not a super prayer because he's righteous. The next thing about how to live together is to draw the sick and the weak in rather than push them to the edges. It's very culturally normative that sick people were marginalised. It hasn't changed a great deal. It says you should call the elders to come with olive oil to say prayers over you, anoint with oil. Should our elders be polishing up their skills with olive oil? And as part of our elders' election, should we have a test? This is a very difficult passage for those who are chronically sick and keep praying, who are friends of God who pray and do not get healed. And we have those amongst us. I particularly asked Christy and Mark this week what I could say on this, because I didn't feel I could with integrity stand here and speak about it without it. The Greek understandings of health and illness at the time included a range of responses. It included very limited understandings of what was actually going on when you were sick. But it did have folk remedies, and it did have, quite strange, but a professional medical process. But it also had a large degree of cultic practice and religious ritual involved in response to the sick. I suggest that James's use here is saying, if the normative cultural response when someone is sick is to invoke divine intervention in some way, make sure it's within your community and that it's your God. That's a bit lost on us now because it's so abnormal to invoke God in that way at illness. There's a link made between illness and sin. But James is very, very careful to use if. If sin has caused this illness, then praying for healing will also mean you're forgiven. There's also an idea that sin in the whole community can create sickness and suffering in the whole community, rather than the specific person has a specific outcome. So a communal rather than a personal response is also required. Now, I cannot resolve the dark mystery of this just flatly not working a lot of the time. And we are not called to solve that mystery. But we are called to stand with you, those who are sick, to stand with you in that darkness, and to pray there for your healing. Finally, we're called to confess our sins to each other. Now, this is immensely challenging to our way of being together, where we present our good sides. But this is perfection, wholeness and integrity, to know ourselves and each other in all the shades of our lives, not just the presentable sides. And after all the guidelines that James has laid out, surely part of our communal response must be to acknowledge, both individually and as a community, that we have not fulfilled it all. Which brings us to where I began. If anyone wanders from the truth and someone brings them back, both you and they will be healed and saved. Sin is a breach of the interpersonal relationships, and it's an honour-shame society. Deb came and spoke about that recently. It's not a moral thing, it's an honour and shame thing. Our community is more whole, more healed, as each individual comes among us. As each person who has struggled with Christian community finds a place to reconnect. As you live as one of this us, there's no them, it's an us. As you are part of this us of Mount Hawthorn, whether you've been here a little while or a long while, we together make you whole. And you make us whole. Not because it's romantic and lovely and we like each other, but because our wholeness, including honestly owning our failings, in that wholeness, we gradually rub each other's edges away. And that's where I think we are. So in summary, I'll say some of those key things again. If you're only listening to a bit, I'm nearly done. In summary, the truth in James is not an intellectual assent to a set of beliefs. It's a communal observance of a shared identity as friends of God, and it's active. Friends of God seek to hold God central in all areas of our lives, including our work and our money. To stand with God on the side of the poor, which is always active in James. There is no standing somewhere and not doing anything. Endure the unfairness and trust that God will put things right. Speak well of each other. Live with integrity. Pray. Hold our sick close. Confess sins. And urge each other back to being friends of God, the compassionate, who is the great friend. So let us, as Mount Hawthorn, as our great commission, be a community of friends of God, living out that great commission to extend love to wandering souls as they reconnect with their identity as friends of the God of love. I've gone a little bit long. We're right at 11, but I'm open for comments or questions. Ken, can we use the microphone? Because lots of people listen at home and they miss the questions if you don't hear it.
Thanks very much, particularly for that bit at the end, because I was sitting there thinking about the wanderer coming in isn't so that we can be nice to them, it's because they have something that we need. Mm. Yeah, that's really important to me. But if I can offer just an and also to some earlier stuff, my understanding from personal study of the early church is that the reason it spread so well is it flew under the radar. It flew under the radar because it went on trade routes. It went by way of merchant routes. And one of the key people in an early Pauline community was a female trader in the colour purple, which at the time was the most expensive by weight thing in the world. And it was actually her position as a wealthy person. You know, it's a bit like the person who was able to circumvent Nazi atrocities because they had some wealth to be able to do it. You know, the and I guess I just wanted to offer that as an and also. We don't have to go with the wealth is bad, poor is good thing. And I don't think you were saying that, but I just wanted to offer it as an and also.
Thanks for raising that. The key thing is about the wealth being used or not used rather than having it. Paul has a very different understanding of socioeconomics, and this community is probably not one of the ones that spread. This is one of the ones near to home. But Paul's idea is very strongly that we are all equal before God, and that's really pushed at the expense of that actually some people in your society are not equal and you need to stand with them. And that because the Protestant church in particular has picked up Paul so strongly as their great flag, some of the socioeconomics has got lost. And James is a way that it gets recovered because he's coming from a different social context where poverty is more of an issue. So thank you.
Well, this actually takes me back to the Beatitudes with what Jesus said. We had an experience when we were in Israel. I was asked to read the Beatitudes up on the mountain, which made me think fairly hard about it. But what struck me when I was reading the Beatitudes was as you read them, he was talking to the people themselves. For example, we read, "Blessed are the poor," and we think about the poor. What he really meant was, "Blessed are you, the poor," or "Blessed are you who are persecuted." There's a very personal address there between Jesus and his audience, which we lose when we read it and we talk about the poor, the persecuted. That's those people over there.
In fact, in at least one of the versions of the Beatitudes, it says that, "Blessed are you, the poor." Yeah. When I said this is the strongest tone against wealth, this polemic tone in the New Testament, the other place it comes up is in Luke's Beatitudes when he goes on to say, "And woe to you who are rich." That's the same language, the same tone. It's the only two places it's as strong as this.
Claire, just a quick one. Have you got a different perspective of James now?
Yes, I think so. I still have to struggle with a lot of the culture that comes out of James and re-own it. But it's why I like preaching on a text I don't choose, because I strongly believe that God can speak through whichever bit comes up, and that's extremely challenging for me when I've got lots of baggage like this time.